I am going to start recording now. We've gotten several requests to record our session. So this is the HB 1923 meeting on duplex, triplex, courtyard apartments and duplexes on corner lots. So thank you for joining us. And unfortunately for the recording, I missed the beginning, but we are jumping into the major meat of the session. So please enjoy this next session. And moving on, that's the wrap up from our introduction. And now I'd like to introduce Joyce Phillips, Senior Planner at Olympia. Olympia has extensive experience on missing middle housing. They adopted far-reaching codes in 2018, but unfortunately they were invalidated by the Growth Management Hearings Board. So now they're working to adopt slightly revised missing middle housing that is compliant with HB 1923. And given their extensive experience, we wanted to invite them to share about what they are doing and some of the details about how they are adopting those codes. So Joyce, thank you for joining us.
Sure, thank you for having me. So as Laura mentioned, we did go through a rather extensive process to develop some missing middle housing ordinances for the city. It was a two-year process, and we looked at accessory dwelling units, duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, courtyard apartments, and single room occupancies. And we did go through and look at the individual zoning districts and which ones should allow which housing types. We looked at our lot size dimensional standards. We looked at parking and owner occupancy requirements for ADUs. And we tied some of the housing types to proximity to transit. And it ended up being a very polarized, conflicting group of people at the end. So there were people who were like all in, all for it. And then there was a group of people who were all opposed, didn't really want to see any code changes. And ultimately, they did appeal the city of Olympia on 12 issues, I believe. The city prevailed on 10, but we did not prevail on 2, and they invalidated the entire ordinance, which was a little bit frustrating. And we have, obviously, we still have some frustration around the outcome because we are pursuing it in an appeal. So we do have some hearing dates coming up in December and January. And so we are still pursuing that appeal of our missing middle housing work, while we also pursue some of these housing options under House Bill 1923. And so I wanted to share my screen, if that's all right, and just talk about some of the work we're doing currently under House Bill 1923. And can you guys see my slides?
We can see them.
All right. And so basically what we're working on now is having some staff recommendations around 3 of the housing options. So we are also pursuing the ADU option. We're also pursuing the duplex on corner lots option and pursuing the duplex, triplex, and courtyard apartment options. Many of the recommendations are extremely similar to or the same as the recommendations that were in the missing middle housing ordinance. And so I think it's a little confusing to some members of the public. We've also made some changes in response to some of the issues that were brought up during the missing middle housing appeal before the Growth Management Hearings Board. And so I think that we've done a good job of trying to kind of factor in some of those issues. So we just had our public hearing on September 23rd. The public comment period for written comments ended on September 30th, and the Planning Commission began its deliberations on October 5th. They didn't get through everything, but so really I'm going to be talking about what our staff recommendations are and how we got there. So the option is specific to duplex, triplexes, or courtyard apartments on each parcel in one or more zoning districts. And so when we went through this, we looked at it from a perspective of we could address the housing types separately. So we could have different recommendations for duplexes than we might for triplexes or courtyard apartments. Because it says on each parcel, we took that to mean we could not have different lot sizes for different housing types. It would be the same dimensional and development standards for each lot. And you would have to show that you could, make it fit within the setbacks and the impervious surface coverages and hard surface coverages and things like that, regardless of which housing type you were proposing to build. And then we also decided we could consider our zoning districts separately. We actually have 6 zoning districts that implement our low density neighborhood comprehensive plan designation. And so we wanted to take a look at each of those differently, and some have some environmental constraints, and we wanted to be able to factor that in as well. So I'm just gonna run through our recommendations, and they're really not that challenging code-wise to write. It's just a matter of what's consistent with our comprehensive plan, what types of comments are we getting back from the public, and how the Planning Commission will ultimately decide to go. So for duplexes, we were looking at allowing new duplexes in the R4 and the R4 to 8 zoning district. And those are our density ranges. So the R4 zone is 4 units per acre. R4 to 8 is 4 to 8 units per acre. And so we wanted to allow new duplexes in those zoning districts on any parcel of any lot of record. We also proposed to remove our larger lot size and lot width requirements in the R6 to 12 zone. And that would free up, you had to have a lot that was twice as wide as a standard lot in order to have a duplex, which might be okay if every duplex was side by side and of equal size, but it really doesn't make sense with some of the newer ways of having duplexes. So, a 2-story duplex where so we just wanted to kind of even out that playing field in the R6 to 12 zone. But we did have some specific standards around ensuring that they were limited to the same height and the same number of stories as a single family home. So you'll see that throughout some of our recommendations. So basically in these zoning districts, any lot could be a single family home or a duplex home, as long as you could show you met the requirements of the zoning district. The one thing that is different for duplexes is we require 2 off-street parking spaces per unit, rather than just 2 for a single family home. So for a duplex, you'd have to show that you could accommodate 4 parking spaces on site. For triplexes, we weren't proposing to allow triplexes in the R4 to 8 zone, and that's significant. In Olympia, the R4 to 8 zone is about 48% of our urban growth area. So we had people at the public hearing asking that we do allow triplexes in the R4 to 8 zone, which was kind of surprising. And then we also have a number of people who don't want triplexes in the R6 to 12 zone. So we currently do allow triplexes in the R6 to 12 zone, but only in a very, very small sub area. And they had different requirements. So they could be 3 stories. So what we wanted to do was eliminate the lot size restriction, allow triplexes across the R6 to 12 zone, note that they would have the same height and number of stories as a single family home. And then when we get to 3 units or more in our parking code, we note that it's 1.5 spaces per unit, which would be 4.5 for a triplex. And we wanted to acknowledge that at least 5 parking spaces would be required for a triplex in the R6 to 12 zone. We have some language in the parking code that would allow for some reductions, and we didn't want that to be the case in the R6 to 12 zone, primarily because a large portion of the R6 to 12 zone in the city of Olympia is around the Capitol, and there's a lot of parking issues in that neighborhood. We also have a lot of, it's an older, beautiful neighborhood, but it has a lot of conversions already. And so parking is really tough in that area for both of those reasons. So we just wanted to clarify that. It was a big issue as part of our missing middle housing. And we hoped that by addressing that in the code, it would alleviate some of those concerns from the public. We currently do not have a definition of courtyard apartments, and we have some zones where we allow apartments, and most zones in the lower density neighborhood where we do not. And so we wanted to provide a definition of courtyard apartments that would acknowledge that we would be requiring a different type of open space than we would for most of our apartments. So we have a definition that includes some development standards for the shared green space in the middle, the actual courtyard itself, that there's some private open space requirements for each lot and or each unit, and then also any of the units on the ground floor that have connection to the courtyard would need to have a direct access from the courtyard into the unit. We acknowledged that the height and number of stories should be the same, and we made those modifications in the code. And then we wanted to allow them across the R6 to 12 zone, but we also acknowledge that it's not very likely that we will get new courtyard apartments in the city. Most of the lots are close to the 5,000 to 6,000 square foot range, probably really not large enough to accommodate something like this. But we have standards in place, and potentially if people consolidated parcels or found some of the larger parcels out there, there could be some courtyard apartments. We also have some existing courtyard apartments that we were able to, obviously this picture is not from the city of Olympia, but we have some existing courtyard apartments in the city that we were able to point out to folks, and they do really fit nicely into the neighborhood, and when they're done well, they can be a nice complement to existing neighborhoods. So again, just kind of trying to have some standards in place that would allow these to blend into the existing neighborhood. And I'm not spending any time in this presentation to talk about design review, but we do require design review for all of these housing types, and especially with a nod to other types of residential structures that are on the same street. So they do have to have a neighborhood consideration and specifically look at the types of construction that are on the same street where these are proposed. And that's true for all of these housing types. One of the things that was a sticking point for the missing middle, and so I might not have thought of this if we hadn't have gone through that particular appeal earlier, but so our comprehensive plan talks about low density neighborhoods and has a description of that, and that's really anything that's up to 12 units per acre. However, if we were allowing these housing types on each parcel, we might not have the ability to kind of factor in that density review. We look at density when property is subdivided, and we look at density for projects that go through our land use approval process, and that's generally 5 units or more. So duplexes and courtyard apartments, if they could show that they met the requirements, they would just be kind of issued building permits to go ahead and proceed. So we wanted to be able to capture that there could be this ability for the density of the zone to be exceeded at some point. And so we have some language in our plan, in our development regulations, where we talk about density, and we added a new provision that would require the city to look at the permitting for these types of homes that have gone in on an annual basis, and to try to keep track of that and see how we're doing density wise. And then ideally, if we're doing this on an annual basis, we will know if we begin to reach or even exceed that density and have the opportunity to make revisions as needed. The language is broad. It's a little bit vague by design, which is very frustrating for some people in the community. But we wanted to be able to, we didn't want to kind of box ourselves in and say we're going to look at it on a zoning by zoning district level. So we're just really, the requirement is that we look at it at the comprehensive planning level. I'm sure we will also be looking at it by zoning district, by neighborhood, by block. I'm sure we'll be analyzing it in more than one way, but we wanted to have that requirement for the city to kind of hold us accountable to make sure our development regulations and our comprehensive plan stay consistent. I also noted that we could make revisions as needed, but I didn't say what those revisions might be. So it could be revisions to the comprehensive plan, or it could be revisions to the development regulations over time. That's kind of still yet to be seen. So that's all I have. The webpage where all of these draft code amendments are provided is olympiawa.gov/housingcode. You can also find all of the missing middle work at olympiawa.gov/missingmiddle. And so feel free to look through any of that, and feel free to call me if you have questions or want to chat about any of the lessons learned through the missing middle housing debate. One thing that I will say is this has been a lot easier because the options were sort of predetermined. So we weren't creating them all from scratch. The flip side of that is we also have people who are frustrated because they want these housing types tied more to some of our collector or arterial streets, which also ended up being our transit routes in a lot of cases. And so we don't have that same flexibility to tie to transit routes or other things like that. But so that's all I have. I'm happy to turn it back over to you now, Laura.
Great. Thank you so much, Joyce. There were a few questions, and I'm having some feedback, so I'm going to pause and come back.
I can manage the questions, Laura. Joyce, they're both about parking. One is mine and one is Kayleen's.
Okay. Sure. So I see that one is, can the parking be met with on-street parking, or does it all have to be off-street parking? We have some specific provisions in our code for residential that require off-street parking. It has to be on the private property itself. We do allow some provisions to count for mixed use developments. We do allow some off-street parking to count, but for residential, it all has to be on site. And then I had another question about parking. Do garages count towards parking requirements? For an example, a duplex with two single car garages and a driveway in front of each could technically be four stalls. Yes, we do consider that four stalls. We count tandem parking. If somebody has a two car garage or two single car garages and a driveway, then yes, we would count that as four stalls total if it was a two car garage. We do have general requirements. So if someone wanted to widen their driveway, as long as the widened portion of their driveway kind of falls within our parking width standards, we would count that as well. So I'm currently working with someone who is interested in converting their detached garage into an office space, but would be eliminating one of her two on-site parking spaces. So what she will probably do is widen her driveway by an extra 5 feet. And that would give her the minimum width for that portion of her driveway. It'll still be narrow where it accesses the alley, but then it'll widen out and she'll be able to accommodate two on-site parking spaces. They do have to be hard surfaced, but they don't have to be covered. So we try to be flexible with the parking.
Thank you. And we have one more question from Elise from Redwood. Do you see potential conflicts with impervious surface limits similar to single family residences with the higher parking requirement for duplex, triplex?
Right. So we do actually see a little bit of a conflict there. And the way we've described that is either people won't be able to accommodate it, so they wouldn't be able to have the additional unit or units, or they'll primarily take place on some of those larger lots. So, some of the lots are 8,000 square feet or 7,000 or, so not every lot will be able to accommodate all of these housing types. And so that has, in some ways, helped people. We do have a lot of people who are very concerned about stormwater and rainfall. So hopefully that will help them feel better that we are still looking at stormwater issues. Some of that is related to proposed changes for our ADUs as well. We currently do not allow ADUs that are not attached to the home to exceed 16 feet in height. We're proposing to increase that to 24 so that someone could build an ADU above a detached garage. And partly that is to not require so much of the lot to be taken up with footprints and impervious surfaces. We do want to allow more of that natural rainwater infiltration to occur. And also just some of the lots are small enough that they can't really accommodate an ADU unless they put it on top of an existing structure. So we're also trying to kind of help meet them in that way as well. But yes, and yeah, stormwater is a big deal. It's always challenging, especially after we've switched to the low impact development stormwater standards.
And if I may have a follow-up question, what are your impervious standards? Can you summarize them? Is there a certain percentage that your district?
There are different percentages and they vary by the zoning districts. Typically it's about, it also changes depending on the lot size. So there's a lot of variables. It's roughly 50% for impervious surfaces and a little bit higher for hard surfaces. And that is meant to encourage people to switch from the easier solely impervious surfaces like concrete and maybe switch to something that's a little bit more environmentally friendly, like a pervious surface, or like Travis mentioned in Woodland, grasscrete. That's one of the things I'm talking with that property owner about, is doing something that's a little more impervious or a little more pervious and environmentally friendly.
Great, thank you so much. Are there any other questions for Joyce?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. If there are any additional questions, please feel free to put them in the chat bar. And we can maybe circle back to her later, or she can respond to them in the chat bar. And I am trying to find how to share my screen again. So thank you again, Joyce. We'd like to move on to hear from a few other different jurisdictions who are pursuing 1923 work for duplex, triplexes, courtyard apartments, and or duplexes on corner lots. So first, I'd like Lori Barnett from East Wenatchee. Are you on the call with us today?
Yes, I am.
Great. Would you be able to share a little bit about your process? I know, so just for the back record, East Wenatchee has is pursuing both the duplex, triplex, courtyard apartment, and duplex on corner lot options, and they have submitted a first draft.
So yes, we actually haven't gotten, not much farther than that. I just received some work from the consultant yesterday that he spent a little bit more time on the courtyard apartment. So currently the residential low density zoning district only allows duplexes in a situation where the property is across the street from or adjacent to a commercial zoning district, and then that requires at least 8,000 square feet. So what we're looking at doing is allowing duplexes then on corner lots in the RL zoning district, and making sure, you know, one of the objections that we've had from the public is they want to make sure if we're allowing multifamily in the single family zoning district that it doesn't adversely impact kind of the look and the feel, traffic impacts and stuff like that of the existing neighborhoods. We do have a little bit of a unique situation in East Wenatchee in that we have a smattering of multifamily out there because at various points in the 70s and 80s when the properties were in the county, they did allow multifamily in the RL zoning. So some of the folks are kind of used to having it around there. So one of the things that I wanted to do, we hired Makers to help us with some actual designs of what these buildings could be look like and still kind of blend in with the surroundings. So the duplexes on the corner lots, we kind of looked at some other jurisdictions that had already allowed that type of use in a single family. We wanted to make sure that, again, that it blends in with the existing neighborhood. And one of the things was to make sure that they had entrances from different streets. However, we don't want to do that if one of those streets is an arterial. So we did include that, that basically they did not have to adhere to that standard if they were on an arterial. And in fact, we don't even try not to allow any accesses directly to an arterial. The rest of it was just looking at the roof pitch, the eaves, the trims, the windows, again, making sure that they take into consideration the proximity to the single family homes. One of the things that we have had recently an issue with a zero lot line development is that the driveways, they reduced the front yard setback. This was actually in the county, but the county uses our code. And they reduced the front yard setback using the plan development section. And unfortunately, what that meant is if these people park in their driveway, they're actually crossing the sidewalk, and in some cases actually intruding into the street. So we had originally thought about kind of modifying our setback and our parking requirements, but we may be rethinking that because that kind of blew up about, I don't know, a month or so ago. And what our code presently says is off-street parking is required for all residential properties, and it must be behind the front yard setback. So the discussion that we just had with Joyce, where they actually give credit for the driveway, we do not. We don't count that towards the off-street parking requirements. Again, we may or may not go back and change that, but the issue that we need to adhere to is we currently do require a 20-foot setback from the face of the garage to the front setback line, and that at least, you know, gets the vehicle out of the garage before they enter the street. So we may look at, again, trying to allow the driveway parking as one of the parking spaces, but currently we require two parking spaces for single family, two parking spaces per unit for duplex. Multifamily is 1.5. One of the provisions that we've included is a reduction down to 1.25 for multifamily. Some of the other things that we've identified in the code is that we have some inconsistencies with where setbacks are measured, so we're kind of fixing that. Again, with triplexes, what I'm trying to figure out is what I can allow under our existing comprehensive plan, but we are in a review period right now, so I actually could go in and change our density requirements. In the RL district, our density maximum is 8 dwelling units per acre. In the RM district, it's 15 dwelling units per acre. In the RH district, it's 24. And some of the jurisdictions have much higher densities. We, a few years ago, went in and reduced all of our lot sizes to try to meet that density requirement. And so we took like the single family from 7,000 to 5,000. So again, we're looking at that and seeing if, you know, maybe we need to bump up the density in the comprehensive plan to actually reflect or give us some more flexibility, I should say, in that single family zoning district. The courtyard apartments, there was a preliminary definition provided by the consultant, but it's not, you know, particularly specific. It just indicates that it's, you know, multiple units around a central courtyard. I kind of want to refine that a little bit more. We want to make sure that a courtyard apartment is actually a courtyard apartment, not this issue that we're having with what's a cottage housing unit. And, you know, so I want to, again, define that a little bit more. And let's see, with regards to, triplexes, in our multifamily, all of those duplexes, triplexes would always be permitted. The courtyard apartments, those are the ones that I'm having some difficulty making sure that we have addressed all of the potential glitches in our code so that you don't have somebody comes in and wants to do a courtyard apartment. And our code says you can't have more than, you know, a certain number of buildings connected, that kind of thing. Let's see, with regards to our lot coverage, we again, when we did the changes, we bumped up all of our lot coverage. We bumped up our building heights to try to provide some more flexibility. The consultant is recommending that we bump up the RM and RH districts, and potentially the multifamily use in the RL district up to like 45%. Right now we're at 40% in the RL district, 45 in the RM, and 50 in the RH. So that's one of the recommendations. And I really don't have that much more to offer. So if there's any questions. Not if me.
There's currently a question from Jacob Gonzalez of Pasco. Have any jurisdictions revised existing lot coverage maximums to accommodate duplex, triplex? So I guess that, could you answer that question? And then we'll allow others to answer in the chat.
Well, again, our existing code for a triplex requires 8,900 square feet. The contractors recommending, and just using the 15 dwelling units per acre, going down to 8,700. So again, you know, when you take the acreage and you divide it into the number of dwelling units per acre, it kind of gets a little convoluted because you end up with really small lots for single family, which is not really realistic. But we're trying to stick as much as we can to the density. But again, I'm looking at the possibility of maybe just bumping up our densities a little bit more.
And I have a question. How are you working to gain public and council support for the changes you propose? Are you having any pushback yet? Do you think you will have any pushback? And if so, how do you think you'll address that?
Well, that's one of the things that has kind of held us up a little bit, of course, is being, we're at, you know, basically we're phase 1.5, which doesn't give you much latitude with regards to having public meetings. It gives you, well, actually no latitude. So once I actually have this in a format that I feel comfortable distributing it out to the public, we'll start basically that process. We are continuing to have online workshops with council. So again, when we get to a you know, a real staff recommendation, I'll take it to council. We'll get it up on our website. Leavenworth actually just did some public outreach for some work that they've done, and I'm going to contact them and see how that worked out. But I'm hoping to get a dedicated page on our website that basically will allow the public to see these documents. We did have one workshop with the Planning Commission, and they were supportive of at least the draft that I had provided with my proposed changes. So there wasn't a lot of objection to it. Everybody recognizes we have a housing issue, and we need to address that. And the way to address it is to provide more flexibility and hopefully get folks some incentive to do some infill development. We have a lot of 1 acre lots that have one house sitting on it right here in the city. And some of those houses are, you know, pretty much bulldozer material. So if a developer knows that they can get the return on their investment by, you know, having this multifamily tucked in there, then I think we'll have an opportunity to do that.
Great. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions for Lori? All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your hearing from you, and good luck as you move forward on that, especially as you get into the public comment period.
Thank you.
Next, we'd like to hear from Lake Stevens. They have adopted a duplex triplex courtyard code provision, and Russ Wright, director, is here to share. Russ, are you here?
I am. Thank you so much. Again, Russ Wright, the community development director for the city of Lake Stevens. And I'd like to walk you through the process that we went through to look at some infill housing code and some revised regulations. Can I share my screen?
Yes, you should be able to now.
Okay, does everyone see the PowerPoint at this point?
I do. It's coming up. Yes, now we see it.
Okay, very good. Move over here. So with the city of Lake Stevens, we've been a very busy city over the last few years in terms of residential growth, a lot of single family. But as our land supply started to dwindle, we recognized that there was really a need to start looking at missing middle housing. So we've taken some proactive steps over the years, updated our accessory dwelling code. But this around 2018, we really wanted to comprehensively look at the city's zoning code and really consider how do we integrate different types of housing into single family neighborhoods, leading to our infill initiative, where we were going to obviously review duplexes, townhouses, other small multiplexes, as well as different incentives that might be a little different than what you've heard today. So we had some project pillars. We wanted to evaluate our standards to make sure that they did provide for quality housing, but also varied housing to the community. So that was very important. And then how does that lead to attainable or affordable housing in the community with this increased diversity? As I mentioned, this was a pretty wide-ranging project for us. We went through several sections of our code when we did this overhaul. So it wasn't just to create infill standards. We went through the definitions to make sure they supported it. We went through our subdivision regulations, our planned residential developments, our lot averaging, our cluster subdivisions to make sure that they were all in line and modern and could support varied housing types. Went through a zoning cleanup, went through a change in our dimensional standards where we actually reduced several of our lot sizes across the board, reevaluated other dimensional bulk standards that had been in place probably since the 90s, and then specifically looked at our infill standards for the small lot, the duplexes. We also revisited our cottage housing ordinance and again, planned residential development and some other zoning tools. So the big thing for us was the public engagement. Since this was such a large overhaul of our code, we established a land use advisory committee, which was separate from our planning commission. It ended up having about 25 members, everyone from the master builders, local developers, interested citizens. So very wide ranging group that we put together that then we reported back to our planning commission as well as our city council. Obviously they were participating in the code drafting, the additional coordination with the building industry, and then taking those results and recommendations to our decision makers. So I already mentioned that the land use advisory committee we put together was included in interested citizens, the building industry. We looked at wide ranging data, including doing a visual preference survey with the task force members. We also brought back our buildable lands analysis outside of the formal buildable lands reporting. The city had done its own land capacity analysis a couple of years ago, again, driven by the fact we've been experienced such incredible growth over the last 5 years. We wanted to look at what housing supply is still available in the community, reviewed multiple codes for best practices. And then, as I mentioned, as there were several code amendments going on simultaneously, we had to divide and conquer as a staff to work at the different pieces and pick away at those in a specific order. And then integrating again with our council and our planning commission. So one of the things we found from this task force is they really did support innovative strategies for infill, and going through the exercise of doing the visual preferencing really, I think, helped alleviate a lot of concerns on what the bulk and scale of small multifamily housing could be in single family neighborhoods. And so that was very important. It really helped the community that they felt included in the process and they were heard. And I think, again, using getting stakeholders from the building community and local citizens was very important to get buy-off as we moved through this project. And at the end of the day, there were some changes by our city council, but they were generally consistent with the recommendations from this greater board. So some of the changes that resulted from this project, how did we apply infill standards? Well, we looked at the surrounding neighborhoods. So if there were lots that were 125% greater than the underlying zone, they were eligible up to a maximum of about an acre. Over an acre, we figured they could go through a standard, you know, subdivision or development process. And if the adjacent properties were 50% developed, if there were significant encumbrances on those properties, they were primed to be targeted for infill type development. And then they had to create at least one new unit more than was there. So as we put the standards together, again, we looked at, can we do infill subdivisions? And if that's the case, continuation of single family homes, but they could have reduced lot sizes, some reduced setback requirements, and then potential amenities or incentives if they're producing smaller homes. We looked at the impervious surface requirement that's come up a couple of times today, and we actually did provide a bonus, a 5% bonus for infill development to try and achieve that goal of additional housing and realize that more hard surface would be taken up. Looking at the lot sizes and for the duplexes and triplexes in particular up to quadplexes, we did provide a sliding scale. So lot sizes would have to increase from a minimum of 125% for duplexes up to 175% of the minimum lot size for fourplexes. So really did take that into consideration and how we can alleviate some of the issues we've heard about today. Aside from just using the bulk standards, is there sort of a reality point that we needed to look at to integrate these different types of homes? And as I mentioned, we went through the visual preferencing. That was very important that we had to consider the design standards. So they're not harsh design standards as far as a specific set of guidelines, but a set of principles. The frontage pattern, it needs to be consistent. The overall look of the structure needs to be consistent with the overall patterns of the neighborhood. If it's going to something more like the fourplex, they can provide some landscape buffer between less dense neighborhoods. So a lot of common sense things, but also making sure that these more intense developments in single family neighborhoods could be easily integrated. So again, just running through the changes that we looked at overall, first, I'll say, as we did this, we had to go to our comprehensive plan and make sure what we were proposing in the zoning code would be consistent with our comprehensive plans. And in the most case, it already was that our comprehensive plan already alluded to small multifamily within single family zones. So that was consistent. First thing we did is we amended our subdivision regulations, as I mentioned, to make sure we had a lot of tools in the toolbox and that they were complementary. Overall, we did an overhaul of our zoning regulations, and then the next incentive was the infill regulations that included both small subdivisions, an overhaul of our cottage code, and the new duplex, triplex, and quadplexes, as well as courtyard apartments. So some of the challenges I've already mentioned, you know, there are the market drivers. There's been a high demand for single family housing in this community, but we do know there's a dwindling land supply. About 300 acres is about what we have left at this point, and a lot of that's going to be infill. There had been some discontent among the greater community because of the massive amount of new subdivisions that had been created. So we wanted to be sensitive to those concerns as we looked at what does infill look like and the design standards. And I mentioned that we did this in-house. We do have lean staffing, but again, we all looked at specific code elements to bring this entire package forward to the community. And some of the lessons learned, make sure you can communicate to your stakeholders, why are you doing this project? What are you trying to accomplish? Broad representation from a variety of perspectives. And it was super important, as I mentioned, to go through the visualization process so people could really understand what does the implementation of this code look like, which again, in the beginning for us, we did the visual preferencing surveys, but then throughout we developed very specific graphics to put in our zoning code and our infill code so people could really tangibly understand what are we trying to accomplish. One thing I would do differently is I would have had a planning commission or a city council rep on this task force. We've subsequently done another task force where we did that, and that direct inclusion just ended up with greater buy-off at a more immediate term. With that, that's sort of the project we have. I do have Sabrina Gasway with me as well today, the associate planner that helped on this particular project. So I'm open to any questions for myself or Sabrina. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. And thank you for addressing both the challenges and the lessons learned. I think those are going to be really helpful for communities who are on the call. We did get a question from Mike asking if you'd be willing to share your visual preference survey. And Sabrina mentioned that you can share it, and that material will be provided to Commerce so it can be distributed to attendees. So I will send that out in a follow-up email. Are there any other questions for Lake Stevens? I do have a question. Russ, can you share a little bit more about the incentives that you incorporated into your code for infill development? Touch on that a little bit more, because I think that a lot of communities want to see the infill development, but there almost needs to be a little bit of a push or a little bit of an extra carrot to get there, because it's not always the easiest thing to do. Can you speak to that and how you came up with those incentives?
Sure. So when we talk about incentives a lot in terms of affordable housing, you're talking about inclusionary zoning or mandates. We didn't take that approach. We wanted this to be more market driven and get that buy-off. And so that's where we looked at how can you get an additional unit? We'll do lot size reductions of say up to 20% for these infill subdivisions. We'll reduce your setbacks. We have a 10 or a 15 foot side setback where that would be all setbacks combined. In this case, you just have to do 5 foot setbacks. Again, an increase in impervious surface, parking requirements, allowing a varied parking to take place. It could be your standard 2 spots per dwelling, but we also provided that you could do a parking lot, you know, an attached parking lot where you could combine all of the parking for your development. So again, trying to really look at these flexible market-driven tools that we could put forward with the dimensional standards.
That's really great. Thank you so much. And for all of you on the call, that code is already adopted. So please take a look at that on their website. And I'll also be posting it to EasyView as soon as I can. Anne asks, have you had any takers? Are builders developing missing middle in Lake Stevens?
So this is a pretty new code, but there is one group that's reached out to us through a pre-app process that is looking to take advantage of this. And we do have a duplex short plat underway right now. And I know that Sabrina in particular has had several people reach out to her with some interest in how this can be applied to future projects.
Great, that's exciting. All right, well, thank you so much, Russ. I really appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing your visual preference survey. I think that will be helpful to communities if they are at the point where they have not already gotten past that point to get that input. So thank you.
Thank you for letting me participate today.
Oh, happy to have you. Next, we'd like to hear from Wenatchee. They have also adopted their duplex, triplex, courtyard, and duplex on corner lot codes. So Glenn DeVries is Community Development Director. And welcome. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm going to try to share my screen here. Let's see how this works. Can everyone see the screen?
I can.
Wonderful. Great. Last year, we adopted a major overhaul to our housing code, zoning code, subdivisions, and new design standards. We were facing, prior to that, in 2017, we did a huge overhaul of our comprehensive plan and really laid the foundation for what we did. We were facing a deficit in our area of about 1,600 market rate units in the valley, and at that time, a 0.5% vacancy rate. We've been historically a dense community constrained by topography. And then along the way, I mean, we had missing middle housing historically, and along the way, zoning came along and precluded blended densities. We've been doing aggressive sewer system investments and multifamily tax exemptions and other tools, but we knew that we needed a multifaceted strategy to better do infill and efficient use of land for our future growth. So one of the questions we were asked to address was which zoning districts we chose and why. Our comprehensive plan update process really helped us identify that, which zones weren't achieving our densities and the broken tools that weren't getting us there. We did a detailed parcel by parcel land use inventory and analysis and looked at which densities, what we were achieving density wise. And ourselves and makers helped us look at the code structure to figure out and past development what was broken. We have a rich heritage of missing middle housing. It really was helpful for us for communication to community members on what could be achieved and what we couldn't do under current codes. Using visual preferencing tools and rich graphics from makers, pictures of existing historic housing. We were able to identify that diversified housing and blended density can be achieved in any district with appropriate codes and design standards scaled accordingly. We had great feedback from our community. We had our Valley process, which is a regional process of jurisdictions and community members. There's a 1,700 member response to a survey giving us really good feedback. And they wanted, the feedback from the communities, they wanted the diversified housing and they wanted predictability for the neighborhoods and the developers. So that was our task. And essentially where we ended up was we have commercial and mixed use districts, which are much more form-based in their approach, and then a mixture for our residential districts. But really, for the purposes of today, looking at four districts, our lower densities to medium density districts have the greatest changes. And it's a hybrid of form-based design and development standards where we ended up with for those districts. So our comprehensive plan, again, laid the foundation with really good targeted policies. I love a plan that actually means something. We spend a good bit of time doing a targeted request for proposals, looking for good urban design and architectural expertise and zoning tools, looking at missing middle, and then some of the wonderful articles that makers have participated in, such as blended densities over time. Are you hearing this, Scott? We had laying the foundation for a process. We started off with three technical advisory committee meetings, really broadly representing the community. It's so important. We spent 18 months on our comprehensive plan update and 18 months on our code update. And kicking this off with that broad representation was important. We integrated council members and planning commissioners in with that broad group to have that to be informed from the beginning and being stakeholders for that process. And then they were able to go back to the planning commission and council and ratify that process. We had four open houses, beginning with heavily focusing on visual preferencing and graphics, and then leading up to code choices and getting really good public feedback through that process. Four planning commission workshops. But then in addition to and above and beyond of those workshops with the Planning Commission, we integrated our technical advisory group with council members, planning commissioners, and the broad-based community for three additional meetings. We had two council workshops, but the beautiful thing is the council members were attending a lot of these other sessions, so they were informed before it came to them. And then we had two developer forum presentations, which were very well attended, meetings with stakeholder groups, and then just the typical maintaining our website, email notice list. And then we had a really good partnership engagement with our local media and press, getting the word out and the need for these changes. What did we learn from our process? What was really important? I think we got there at the very end and got this message across to our decision makers that you really need to build in time and acknowledge that there will be gaps and errors when you're making dramatic changes, and that's okay. Being transparent in that and building that in as a necessary component, that you're not failing if you have some errors or things you need to come back and look at, and building that in. Implementation and monitoring are key. Asking the community and your stakeholders to be partners and help you review that code and look at what tweaks you need to do. At the same time though, I think it's been fun to watch the Planning Commission on some changes that have been requested, because they really took ownership of that code and want to maintain those provisions and are very resistant to things that would eliminate them because they're proud of it and proud of what it can do for our community. And one of the things we've been frustrated on with COVID is that we haven't been able to be as aggressive on our outreach and tools for both sophisticated and small scale developers and community members so that they can access and learn about our tools. But we'll continue to work on that. One of the things that was asked is that we look at, you know, how we did this blending of densities, accommodating these densities specifically on design guidelines. I think a lot of folks have talked about the zoning code components, and we certainly updated ours, in fact, gutted what we had and redid them, you know, starting with process. Can you do the use, moving to outright permitted uses and avoiding plan developments, which I hope I never see ever again, which our code doesn't allow anymore. It's predictability, again, for the neighborhood, for the developer. Outright permitted uses subject to development and design standards. And then zoning, after it's a permitted use, can your site accommodate the use? Looking at, again, new site development, residential use standards, updated parking, landscaping, and subdivision components to accommodate it. But one of those were certainly brand new updates, replacements for what we had, but we never had really good design standards before. And we now have a separate document, which is rich graphically in examples, looking at maintaining the characteristics of what we have that are positive and enhancing those characteristics as we move forward for our neighborhoods. And really the structure of those design guidelines are starting with a big element, site planning, and then looking at site details and third building design. And I'm going to move quickly through these. These are just some components in the guidelines. Our guidelines are available online. Looking at things such as for site planning, such as entries, relationships to private and public streets, parking and open space, service areas, locations and screening. The relationship to adjoining residences or districts that may be of a different scale, massing, and how you can accommodate that and blend those. Avoiding entrapment areas, looking at security, visibility, pedestrian connectivity, accessibility. The picture on the right is a really neat existing missing middle development in the city. These pictures of existing development really help resonate with your community, did for us. Open space elements, looking at examples, sizing, making it meaningful, lighting standards, and then into building design. And again, looking at neighborhood character, looking at existing neighborhood character was really significant for a community, but balancing that, allowing for new, but looking at existing features and giving some options. And so what the approach that Makers developed in order to implement our comprehensive policy on that, plan policies, was to come up with neighborhood characteristic areas and then a matrix which provides options, things to carry forward in design, also opportunities for innovation, things that are different, but incorporating some of the features that are present in the neighborhood. And it's a broad list. Our development community was very supportive of it. They're not concerned of it about it because there are so many options to get you there, and there are is the ability to innovate and do something different. It doesn't necessarily mean that the development's going to be the same as those around them, but these features, massing, character, open space, light, the design standards, all help that blend into the neighborhood and maintain a good quality of life, something to be positive. So by area, we have that as a matrix component that can be chosen. And then just looking at different typical, you know, build design components, facades, articulation, modulation, windows, treatments, weather protection, windows again. Looking at some material requirements, and just as we did required certain features to be present by character area, we also have some treatment requirements, things to be encouraged, things to be not allowed or minimized by character area for the city. And so how are we doing? We're currently going through a minor modification to catch some of those errors or omissions. And we envision that we'll have one additional next year, but it's been very positively received. We're having people use the standards, and we look forward to more outreach and implementation going forward. It's pretty exciting to have these new sets of tools. That concludes my presentation. I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Glenn. That's wonderful. This is exciting seeing your design guidelines. These are some great examples. And I love the examples of not only what to do, but what not to do. That helps you to be able to point to which category the development is in. We did receive a question from Anne from Othello. How did you get so many responses to your survey? I'm pretty sure this was a question for Glenn.
I think the R Valley process, the participants are broad-based. It has a wide variety of stakeholders. I think that the stakeholders have been able to, you know, help motivate people to participate. Our press is a wonderful partner in getting the word out. I think the need, though, essentially the housing crisis we had in the Valley at that time, I mean, it's continued. We are making progress. I think that helped people want to participate as well, just because so many people are being impacted. Our costs here compared to the rest of Eastern Washington tend to be 40 to 50% higher than, say, looking at Spokane or the Tri-Cities. So, and then the biggest correlation to homelessness are housing costs. So you see the significant impacts and the need, and those helped really drive the concerns to actually comment and want change.
Great, thank you. There are a few additional questions in the chat box, but they seem to be general and not specific for Wenatchee. Are there any other specific questions for Wenatchee?
This is Anne. I have a question. My question in the chat is about outreach to developers with these new options. So, and you said because of COVID, you couldn't be more aggressive. If it wasn't a COVID world, how would you have been more aggressive?
Yes. Oh, sorry about that. We're going to be going and doing outreach to different organizations and doing presentations to those, surveying groups, realtor groups, builder groups. We'll be doing a lot of that. Another thing we're going to be doing again is we hold as a city developer forums. We'd like to do outreach on our final product. We're working on packets that are digital and also paper so that we can, as folks come in or look online, that they have some really good graphic tools and very simple steps to understand their choices more. Really a marketing tool so that folks know the range of options, the palette that they and easily can choose the palette that they want to work with in their neighborhood.
Great. Any other specific questions for Wenatchee? Well, thank you so much, Glenn. This was really helpful. I do have a question that we received in advance of the webinar. One participant was interested in asking about ownership of duplexes and triplexes and handling utility and other hookups. Sierra, could you maybe, I think you're on the call, could you articulate that question? Because I don't think I conveyed it accurately. I wanted to make sure we post it to the panel and to all the attendees. Are you there? I think you're still on mute. Okay, I believe she's still on mute. Can anybody speak to that question?
I could from Wenatchee, at least. From what
Great, thank
done.
You.
We've done something called a unit lot subdivision. And what it lets you do is for those types of uses, do the development from a site planning perspective, and then you can come in concurrently or after the fact and do a unit lot subdivision either around the unit or in a larger area and look at a homeowner's, a tool such as a homeowner association for long-term maintenance of the shared area. It's been very popular in our community. We actually had it before this update process and have modified it somewhat, given that condominiumization has its challenges and not as much interest. The ability to have fee title ownership is highly desirable, and so it's been a tool very well received for these types of developments.
And what did you say that was called?
It's called a unit lot subdivision.
So we could Google that or look that up in your code and find that?
Correct. And for 9 units or less, it's a short plat. For greater than, it would be a subdivision processed in the same manner.
That sounds like a great tool. I know everybody's interested in, more people are interested in that fee simple ownership. So that's great. Are there any other responses to the question about addressing ownership of duplexes and triplexes, particularly in regard to utilities and hookups?
I would just add, Lake Stevens also has a unit lot subdivision. We recognize that it was pretty important because of a community preference for home ownership. So we allow that, but we also allow that it could be rental. So the utilities, you know, would have to be either addressed through, as suggested, through an association if there is a subdivision involved, or individually with each unit. Unfortunately, we're not the purveyor of our utilities, so it's not as easy for us to integrate directly.
Great, thank you. We've received another question from Chris Green. pausing a second. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have time for breakout, so I think we're just going to move into general questions and answers. So I'm going to be reading questions off from the chat bar. Have any communities done specific outreach to lenders about infill duplexes, triplexes, and has it been well received? Chris, can you expand on your question when you say outreach to lenders in terms of financing for duplex, triplex projects?
Yeah, exactly.
City of Wenatchee incorporated participants that from lending institutions in their process. And while these forms of development now are somewhat new to Wenatchee, they've been very well received, and the lending institutions are moving forward with support for either construction or purchasing of them. And so just integrating that, I think it's an important body to have involved in the process for ideas and awareness.
And Anne mentioned that she heard that the city of Lacey is working with local banks to identify which organizations would be willing to finance ADUs. So it sounds like an important group to reach out to, but I'm not hearing a lot of experience in that group. And that may be because some of the jurisdictions don't yet have quite as much of the missing middle housing allowed. So hopefully we'll see more of that in the future.
Laura, this is Lori Barnett at the City of East Wenatchee. And Glenn touched upon our Valley, our future regional planning efforts here. And we actually have in that group a housing solutions group that meets on a fairly regular basis. And one of the forums that we did put on was specific to lenders and talking to them about these, you know, more innovative housing options. And they were very receptive to it. Again, the ADUs have been kind of difficult. Across the state, they don't like to loan on properties that have more than one unit on it, especially if it's in a single family neighborhood. So we kind of talked about it, and I think that the local lenders were very receptive to that idea.
Thank you.
Travis of Woodland asked, for unit lot divisions, does each unit pay a connection fee? So that would, I think, targeted to Lake Stevens and Wenatchee. If you could answer. How are connection fees handled with unit lot subdivisions?
This is Russ, again, Lake Stevens. That would really be up to the discretion of our utilities. We don't have our sewer or water, but historically there have been separate connections for separate units.
Yes, I believe there are separate connection fees, but the and we're trying to get the folks to think about this, you know, early on with their building permit process so that they're the utility, how they put them in, is as efficient as possible on them. But yes, I believe they're separate fees.
Great, thank you. And Mike McCarty asks, is anyone aware of developers that want to do integrated missing middle developments with a combination of different typologies? Have you had any interest meetings? Has anybody had any interest meetings on that front?
This is Sabrina with the City of Lake Stevens. We have had some interest. However, it's been minimal. Mostly it's in combination of doing triplexes and duplexes when necessary, because the sites don't meet the requirement to be able to do all three triplexes, so they reduce it down to one triplex and two duplexes.
That makes sense. And it also adds a bit of a neighborhood variety in terms of So I can see how that could be a positive thing.
Correct. It's more of a market-driven aspect than interest in the mixing itself.
Yes. Great. Well, with just 7 minutes left of our meeting, are there any other questions that anybody would like to pose or that I have not read off from the chat bar? Hearing none, I wanted to wrap up and ask, first I wanted to kind of comment on one aspect that Olympia mentioned. Here at Commerce, we are asking jurisdictions as you look towards allowing duplexes and triplexes to look into providing those options for duplexes and triplexes on as many lots as possible. We understand that duplexes and triplexes do sometimes take additional land. So we do recognize that there are probably community concerns with having more units on the same lot size as a single family home. But as Joyce pointed out, duplexes and triplexes don't have to be on their own piece of land, they could be stacked. So we would like you to consider minimizing the additional sizes of land, of lots that are needed for duplexes and triplexes. We think that the original intent of the code was to not add additional land. However, we understand that there are community concerns and also concerns with community character as we add the additional density. So please keep that in mind. We would like to keep that topic open for discussion as you work through your code. So as you are working through that, please coordinate with us. And if you have any questions, we would like to work with you on that. I also want to reiterate that the intention for that is that we don't want existing lots to not be able to take advantage of the code changes. So if your primary lot size is 8,000 and you say duplexes are only allowed on 10,000 square foot lots, you're essentially saying only those very large lots are allowed to have duplexes, and the impact of that code change is minimal. So something to keep in mind as you move forward. We understand that not everything is going to be possible, but we look forward to working with you on that. And in wrapping up, we would like to ask if there's any other ways that you would like us to assist you. This is the last of our series of virtual meetings with HB 1923 grantees at the moment. We are happy to set up more meetings. So if there's any way we can assist you moving forward, in addition to the code examples that will be posted in a few weeks' time, please reach out to us. My email is here and Ann's is also here. So thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to working with you. And also, just as a quick reminder, if your schedules for your deliverables need to be revised, please reach out to your Commerce point of contact. That contact information is included in the PowerPoint that was sent to all of the attendees. Thank you very much for attending.
Thank you.